In the past few years, the world has made another giant leap into space. Like never before, the world's economy has embraced satellites, especially the incredibly useful GPS navigation satellites. Satellite receivers are being put into mines, trucks, trains, ships, phones, containers of bananas, stock exchanges. Almost everything is now being tethered by digital signals to space. Satellites are fast becoming part of everything we do, from farming to banking and dating to driving. In New South Wales, for instance, the Roads and Traffic Authority is testing a safety device said to be the biggest thing since seatbelts. It's called Intelligent Speed Adaptation, and it's getting drivers to stick to the speed limit and slow down in school zones.
School zone active.
A technologist with the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority, John Wall, says a revolution in road safety is around the corner.
We can use GPS to make what is unpredictable today on the road predictable tomorrow. I guess one of the applications would be dedicated short-range communications. This is where cars are actually talking to each other and telling each other where they are on the network. So if you've got a vehicle, for example, travelling along at a road 90 degrees to you and you're coming up to a rural intersection, this system would actually tell you that there's a car about to enter that intersection way before you could see it and way before any of the new technologies like radar and things that are mounted on some of the high-end vehicles could detect that car. If it detected that that vehicle wasn't going to stop, it would then warn you that that vehicle is likely to collide with you. And in the future, I could imagine automatic systems actually taking over and then braking you if you didn't react to that advice quick enough.
Most countries have planted their feet firmly on the accelerator of their satellite industries. Satellites the size of fridges, and some bigger than cars, are as high as 36,000 kilometres over our heads, humming with data and watching and measuring everything on the Earth's surface. They're helping seal business deals, exchange currencies, and withdraw cash. The global positioning systems, the GPS navigation satellites, have become so useful that the world now relies on their signals. In Canberra, the chairman of the Australian Space Industry Chamber of Commerce is Brett Biddington.
The more important question is, what would the world do without it? And basically the world as we know it, rich countries, poor countries, transport systems, banking systems, food production systems, global supply chains, you name it, would all grind rapidly to a halt if we didn't have access to those signals.
Hello, I'm Ian Townsend and welcome to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, on the internet at abc.net.au/rn and also broadcast around Australia and around the world via satellite. Back in the 1960s, Australia was at the forefront of satellite research. In 1967, it became the fourth nation after the Soviet Union, the US and France to launch a satellite from its own territory. A rocket donated by the Americans carried a research satellite into orbit from Woomera in South Australia. But since then, things have gone downhill for Australia's space industry. Today, it has hardly any satellites to speak of. At Flinders University in Adelaide, space archaeologist and historian Alice Gorman.
In this, I think there is a certain element of cultural cringe, and that may be too simple and glib an explanation, but I suspect there is some of that in there. If you think of all of the expertise concentrated in Australia at a certain point in the development of space exploration and space services, it's almost like at some point we just lost our confidence and thought, well, we can't really compete with the big players here, so we're not even going to try.
There was disappointment in the 1970s when the British, after launching one of their own satellites from Woomera, pulled out of what was called the Anglo-Australian Joint Project.
A lot of the equipment was just destroyed or sold for scrap or used for target practice in military operations. So there was no concerted effort to preserve the expertise that was present in people or the technology or the infrastructure. So we kind of let a lot of that disperse, and we could have kept it. We could have kept it in the country.
That's a shame, because when we were dismantling the Woomera satellite base, other countries started investing heavily in satellites. The result is that for years now, Australia's been begging, borrowing and buying access to foreign satellites. Our weather data comes from an old Japanese satellite, and Geoscience Australia was recently forced to buy images from an Indian satellite after an American Landsat satellite broke down. The director of the Institute for Telecommunications Research at the University of South Australia, Alex Grant.
We have some collaborations and we do things with other international partners, but we haven't sort of really held up our end as what you might expect of a developed nation in terms of getting things into space. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean launching rockets out of Australia and having astronauts and a big space program and contributing to the International Space Station or things like that. There are things that are achievable and have been achieved by countries with kind of a similar population and GDP as Australia.
Canada, for instance, has a dozen satellites and a space industry that earns billions a year. More than 40 countries have nearly 1,000 working satellites between them. Australia, on the other hand, has four satellites, earned by Optus. But you could argue about who really owns them. Optus is 100% owned by Singtel, which in turn is mainly owned by the Singapore government. Lately, the Australian government has been taking small steps towards building its own satellite. It's spent $8.6 million to come up with a national space policy this year and is handing out $40 million in grants for space projects. But that's peanuts if it's trying to establish a local satellite industry. A former bureaucrat now running his own satellite imaging company is John Douglas. He says if we're heading down that path, we should be buying satellites overseas off the shelf.
When I go and buy a car, which is characteristically Japanese or German or something like that, do I want to build that? Do I want to buy all the bits and pieces and make it? Does it have to be made in Australia? Well, we've tried that many times. It doesn't seem we're very good at that, and certainly not competitive. We don't make jet fighters either or rocket ships. The money is not in building satellites, it's in owning the satellites and the value-adding product line. So you might buy it for 25 to 50 million, or a constellation for a couple of hundred million, and then make billions globally over the life of those satellites through the value-adding product.
Space has become a big global business, and it's revolutionising other industries down at ground level, particularly agriculture. About 2 hours' drive north of Adelaide, in the Clare Valley, is Taylor's Winery. It produces 6 million bottles of wine a year.
We can go for a walk sort of in a row adjacent to it. Keep going.
It's harvest time, and that means satellite-guided machines bristling with sensors.
Been to this part of the world before?
Yeah, a couple of times, but a long time ago.
Sure.
It's early morning, and the winery's viticulturalist, Colin Hinsey, is showing me the harvest of Cabernet Sauvignon grapes.
Great harvest of works, basically by rattling the berries off the bunch. There's a set of beating rods inside the head of the harvester, which run at somewhere between 400 and 500 beats per minute. The harvester's travelling at somewhere in the order of 3 to 3.5 kilometres an hour. There's the fans that remove the leaves from the sample, so we pretty much all we're getting through is grapes.
At this time of the year, the harvesters are working around the clock. Aerial images have shown Colin Hinsey where the grapes are ripe. Guided by satellites, the harvesters move in.
What we're looking at is the conveyor belt, and halfway along the discharge conveyor, there's effectively a set of scales under there. It's a metal frame. The tray of the conveyor's been cut out. We've put a metal frame in there instead. There's four load cells which measure the weight of the grapes as they go across the belt. On the end of the belt's a belt speed sensor, so it's measuring the speed of the belt. Speed and mass gives you the flow.
Where does that information go?
Right on top of the cabin we've got the GPS receiver, and then both of those signals go into the cabin where the driver is, and it's just a simple logger. It shows him the accumulated tonnes as he's picking it, so he's got an idea of how much grapes he's put in the bin each time and how much fruit's been delivered to the winery. It's logging the position and the yield as it's being harvested.
That's a lot of information to digest, and it's not really clear what good it all is until you get back to the office.
Come on in.
Thanks.
A massive database is being built that can show, for instance, which vines on which soils in the vineyard produce the best grapes. Aerial images taken before the harvest show the vineyard in a matrix of reds, oranges, blues and greens, showing areas where the grapes are ripe or where more water or fertiliser is needed.
The image that we're looking at is actually showing us just the vineyard rows. And in this particular case, it makes it complicated because halfway along the row, it appears to be lower in vigour and then it changes to be higher in vigour. So what we might see is that the crop load is less where there's the lower vigour. Those grapes will typically ripen earlier. The berries will be smaller and they may well have a different flavour composition in the grapes as well. So one problem is they might ripen early. The second problem is they might taste different and actually be targeted to a different wine style.
All this information is helping winemakers find the best place for a new vineyard. Imagine being able to draw up a wish list of soil qualities and climate, match it to a grape variety, and then let satellites and a computer program find the best spot for that really good wine. Colin Hinsey.
We've taken that information, we've gathered extra information about soil properties, the topography, so using a RTK GPS, a highly accurate, within 1 to 2 centimetre accuracy GPS, to collect the accurate terrain information, to try and distill down what are the key attributes that might lead to new vineyard establishment. So where is an appropriate place to have a vineyard boundary so that within the block it's as uniform as possible? And certainly we've done that on a patch that's 40 hectares. And we won't really know the result of that for 5-10 years down the track once we've established a vineyard and really got it underway. But we've done the first step, which is to use those precision viticulture and precision agriculture tools to look at new vineyard design, yeah.
In this part of South Australia, at the end of a hot summer, brown fields give way to dry and dusty country towns. In a little town called Lobethal in the Adelaide Hills is a company called Apogee.
Hi. Hello.
It buys the satellite images, analyses them, and then sells that information to, say, a farmer or a government department.
Satellites today, John.
Good day, mate.
Good to see you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, now we're in the middle of it, mate.
Oh, yeah, well, I like
things. We're doing space stuff.
Yeah, that's great, that's what I want.
So you want... He's Mr. Space. He's Mr. been around...
The owner is John Douglas. Inside this small office on the outskirts of the town, the staff are busy. On computer screens are satellite images of Queensland, where it's flooding. The Queensland government has been phoning, and John Douglas has been tasking European satellites over southern Queensland to take a look.
These are radar ones, so they see through clouds, work at night. These are German satellites and European satellites. Those satellite data, when they're collected, will then produce here flood maps. So these are basically flood maps from space. So this is essentially giving information to the people like around Charleville and Mitchell, etc., what's actually happening in a broad extent, as I said, through the clouds and even at night. So that's completely different from flying aeroplanes around.
There are three main types of satellites. There are the GPS satellites, the communication satellites for television, radio and phones, and the remote imaging satellites with their cameras. John Douglas buys these images from the foreign companies that own the satellites. What he gets isn't just pretty pictures. The cameras can take photos in ultraviolet, infrared or radar. These images are manipulated in computers to show all sorts of things, from how vigorously crops are growing to how high floodwaters are. The satellites can see through clouds and take photos at night. John Douglas is showing me a satellite image of the West Atlas oil spill off the northwest coast last year. The spill shows up as reds, oranges, blues and greens.
We're using here...
This was the West Atlas rig.
West Atlas rig. Here's where the West Atlas rig was. We're using the satellites on a number of occasions and different satellites to map the oil spill. And then down here we've actually colourised that by analysing the thickness and density of the oil spill. So wherever it's thickest or densest, you put your activities, not down in the green.
The things you can tell from satellite images are amazing, and it's a technology still in its infancy. But already you can buy computer programs that will measure the fire danger in your backyard. Satellites can tell how dry the bush is around your house, how much fuel there is, and the height and slope of surrounding hills. With weather forecasts, it could help you decide whether to stay and fight a fire or flee, and even suggest the safest road out. Satellite images of crops can now be downloaded directly into a tractor's computer to tell it where the insects are bad and where the crop needs more water or fertiliser. That can reduce the use of chemicals and save farmers money. The satellites seem now to be able to measure how much carbon is locked up in a piece of land. John Douglas.
That's going to be important in the future, and that's going to be done by satellites, but by radar satellites, because we've found that you can measure the biomass, and we've just recently done some studies. One of our guys found we can measure the biomass of wheat crops, tonnes per hectare. Now, that's not been done before for lots of reasons, not the least of which there weren't a lot of satellites that could do it. And so that's a completely new area of that.
You can see the potential for carbon trading. The company's now part of a consortium to see if it can map the carbon in Australian forests. But all this data comes from other countries' satellites, and that can be inconvenient and expensive. The big money being made from space at the moment is in owning satellites and selling on the data.
A number of years ago, I visited Brandenburg and met with three people in a room that had a smaller company than I do here. Their vision was to have a series of satellites called RapidEye. Those satellites would be the world's first small constellation of five satellites for agribusiness. So, 4 years later, they're in orbit, their company is flourishing. How the hell did they do that? And this is a company, a startup company, smaller than mine.
What happened was that with the help of the German government, that small company bought the satellites itself.
Now, the end product is, in less time than it's taken us to do any of the reports we have about space, and probably the next one, they've come up with five satellites.
In exchange, the German government was given some space on those satellites to do the things governments need satellites for, things like search and rescue, weather forecasting, mapping, climate research, even traffic control. The list is getting longer. It's a far cry from the Cold War of the 1950s, when the Soviet Union launched the first Sputnik satellites.
Now listen, Mr. Khrushchev, I heard a lot of talk about the satellite missile and the president's fault. You better listen to what I gotta say. Things I'm gonna tell gonna make it hot, turn gray. I got a satellite, baby, with a red hot style that's new. Well, she got more speed than Sputnik number two. You talk about your Sputnik and your hound dog crew. I got a rocket, baby, faster than the Asiatic flu. I got a satellite, baby, with a red hot style that's new. Well, you got more speed than Sputnik number two.
You're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, and that song from 1957 is called Satellite Baby by Roosevelt Sykes. It's referring to the Soviet launch of Sputnik 2, which had a dog on board called Laika. Back then, people went outside to stare up at the night sky, hoping to see a satellite's flashing light. It was called the Space Age back then, but in technological terms, the 1950s and 60s are ancient history.
Hi. Yes, how are you? Good to see you.
In Adelaide at Flinders University, I'm meeting an archaeologist, Alice Gorman, who specialises in space objects.
In those early days, people are looking up to the stars. They're hoping to see a satellite, sometimes with fear, particularly in the US, but many other countries reacted to the launch of Sputnik with wonder and interest. But it changes our relationship to space. So suddenly people are looking up. They're looking up into the sky. And now we don't do that. We don't look up anymore. We've become so used to the fact that these satellites are whizzing around up there, delivering, you know, GPS coordinates to our iPhones and providing us with satellite telecommunications, and we really have come to just take it for granted that these spacecraft are up there doing all this stuff for us, doing all this stuff that we really can no longer survive without in the modern world.
But it's not just satellites flying around up there. It's something more ephemeral, the strange mix of alien and human material and culture in space. Alice Gorman used to study Indigenous cultural heritage on the ground.
The cultural heritage perspective is really quite useful because it makes you think of it as a whole, not just human material dumped into an empty space, an empty vessel, the vacuum that we imagine, because it's far from a vacuum up there. It's full of stuff. It's full of high-energy cosmic rays. It's full of micrometeoroids. There's clouds of plasma. All kinds of things happen in there. So we now have to look at that environment with the human material in it as a whole entity and not separate the two.
When we're talking about satellites and space, we're really talking about a region between 100 and 36,000 kilometres above our heads. Australia is one of a few countries in the world to actually define where space starts. The Space Activities Act says that space starts at 100 kilometres above sea level. Above that height are almost 1,000 working satellites and about 1,500 dead ones. The earlier Sputnik satellites, including Laika the dog, fell back to Earth and burned up long ago. But there are satellites still up there, well on their way to becoming antiques. Alice Gorman.
The oldest satellite still in Earth orbit is Vanguard 1, launched in 1958. It's been up there longer than anything else. It's composed mainly of aluminium, which is a material very widely used in spacecraft manufacture still. It's the only object we have which can show us what happens to human materials after a long exposure to the space environment. So that gives it a scientific heritage value as well as all of the historic and social things we might associate with it being the oldest satellite still in orbit.
After Vanguard 1 was launched, the Europeans started testing and launching their own satellite rockets from Woomera in South Australia.
Here is the briefing for trial HL4.3/5, trial seal number 111. Europa 1, vehicle number F4, will be static fired on launch at 6
What you're listening to is a test run in 1966 of one of Europe's first satellite rockets. The British, French, Italian and German governments called themselves the European Launcher Development Organisation, or ELDO, and were testing a rocket called Europa. Australia was a partner in that program. This is the sound of the actual test launch of the Europa 4 rocket in May 1966. In a remarkable coincidence, while background briefing was at Flinders University, a piece of this rocket found in the desert had just been handed to the School of Archaeology, and Alice Gorman is having her first look at it.
So this is part of Europa.
It's part of a Europa rocket. I really need to talk to Alex, find out where he found it. Maybe he was in the Simpson Desert where we know the F4 came down. I mean, looking at this, you can see, like, people say, well, why do archaeology on space material? Because we have all of the documents. And we do, but looking at this and touching this, like, no document can reproduce that experience.
After its brief foray into space, this part of the Europa rocket crashed to Earth in the Simpson Desert 40 years ago. Today, it still looks new. It gleams.
I feel, looking at it, I think it's just a bit of pipe, but it's so complex. I mean, there are probably 20 different components in this length, which is, I would estimate, to be about 60 centimetres. So there's all these different components made of different metals with different serial numbers on them. So even this little bit of this rocket is just tremendously complex. The other thing, I think, looking at it, you can see many of the machining and tool marks left on the little bits. And that makes me think, well, you know, this was a massive piece of technology. This was a huge rocket. But we can still see the imprint of individuals on this bit. We can still see the bits where somebody was trying to twist the bit of wire to get something to sit in just the right position. And we can still, there's some little crescent-shaped marks on one of the bolts that are clearly part of the machining. And So there are individuals behind this little piece of technology. There are all these individuals that worked together to make this one object that in the end was half a success and half a failure. And I suppose it's just being this close. We think of space as something that's out there. We think of this as technology that's far away from us. But it's not so far away from us. And when you're actually holding a piece of a rocket in your hands, it does make you feel connected with space and with high technology in quite a different sort of way.
But we've lost that sense of connection with the satellites up there now. Back in the 1960s, people were looking up into space looking for blinking lights. Australia then was launching rockets and building tracking stations.
Ladies and gentlemen, I now present the Prime Minister, Right Honourable Harold Holt.
In 1967, the year Australia put its own satellite into orbit, the Prime Minister, Harold Holt, opened the Honeysuckle Creek tracking station near Canberra.
In navigation, satellites can play a helpful role today. In international communication, we've already achieved the first telecast between Britain and Australia. We are but at the beginnings of this improvement in communication, and before we're all very much older, the world can be in television contact as a normal and everyday event.
It was during the Cold War, but there was a sense of wonder about the technology.
And so, as I open formally this tracking station and have with you a vision of what it can contribute to this program in the future, may I adopt the words of Tennyson as a fitting conclusion. Forward, forward, let us range. Let the great world spin forever down the ringing grooves of change. I declare the station formally open.
But during the 1970s, the romance of space faded for Australia. The American Apollo missions ended. Australia's space industry had relied on alliances with the US and the British, but the Europa program had failed and was transferred to French Guiana, where it evolved into the Ariane program that today takes commercial satellites into space. Today, Australia's old partners in space, Italy, Germany, France and the UK, have flourishing space industries worth billions in export income. Australian governments since the 1970s seem to lose interest. Alice Gorman.
So at a certain point, probably after the demise of the Europa program, so after that period, which is sort of the mid-70s, Australia still had a sort of a space agency in those days. From that time, we basically bought in space services. So we didn't follow up on any of our satellite development initiatives. We launched from other countries. We bought other people's satellites, designed and manufactured in other places.
Alice Gorman from Flinders University in Adelaide. Satellites and space were a big part of popular culture back in the 1950s and 60s. And it's ironic that now that space really does play a big part in our everyday lives, it's dropped off our radar. In Brisbane, I'm meeting a technology consultant, Wayne Buckler, in a coffee shop. He's made a career out of talking about new gadgets. Here's one example of what's been produced lately as a result of a fusion of technologies. It's a sort of mobile phone internet program called Foursquare, which knows where you and your friends are at any time of the day. Wayne Buckler.
Foursquare is a geographically aware social networking site. So you have to set this up yourself. It's something you do. But you go on to your Facebook page or your MySpace page or whichever, and you say to your phone, you can tell the world where I am. So every 15 minutes, it will connect to the internet, figure out from the satellites where you are using GPS, figure out where that is from a map of the area, and then say, oh, Fred is at Wayne's Coffee Shop, 123 XYZ Street, in this place. Now, that goes to the social networking site, which goes to all your friends. if they've got you on their phone, it'll alert them if they're close and so on and so forth. But if you turn this round a bit, it also means you're not home. So here is a web... The other website says, here are all the people who we know are not home at present. And if we know where they live because they've got that information published on their Facebook, here's a list of perfect places to rob.
Linking GPS satellites to your mobile phone is opening up a new world of social possibilities. You'll be able to go to a night spot and your phone can exchange information with people who are there, telling you who's single, and if you have any interests in common. The phones could even swap numbers. Wayne Buckler.
I think one of the big drivers that this generation, the younger generation, are using this technology for is to re-establish social networks. You know, the idea that social networks were built around tennis clubs and church socials is well and truly gone. It's almost to the point where you can automatically ask the girl for a date because your phone is talking to her phone and facilitating the meeting. So anything that facilitates that social contact, I think, will be driven in a commercial environment.
So on a Friday night, you could send your phone out in a taxi and they could all meet up at a pub somewhere and talk to each other and you could stay home.
Yeah, I think that might defeat the final ending of the event by most of that generation. I think they have a different outcome in mind to you and I after a night out Friday night.
This is all possible because of the global positioning system originally developed by the American military. Other nations now have similar systems with different names, but most people now use the initials GPS. And GPS works like this. A GPS receiver in a mobile phone receives a signal from a satellite. The time it takes for that signal to reach the receiver tells it how far you are from the satellite. It's astonishingly accurate, especially when you think that the satellite is 20,000 kilometres away and travelling at 2 to 3 kilometres a second. When the signal comes from several satellites at the same time, the software in the phone triangulates your position on the Earth's surface, down to within a metre or so. When you put that together with small gadgets, computer chips and fast internet, the uses are surprising. Soon, for instance, you might be walking down the street with a special pair of glasses that can recognise someone walking towards you. Their name pops up in the middle of the lens. Wayne Buckler.
The idea of the glasses is twofold. One is it puts a screen up so that you can see like a computer screen on the lens of your glass. The other thing is it's got a little pinpoint camera in the middle of the glasses. Now that runs off via wire to a computer in your back pocket. I went to a conference and, you know, when you go to a technology conference, often it's nerdy, and they had a similar setup, not in glasses, but on a card that you hang around your neck or a box that you hang around your neck, and it would recognise the other person and then project their name on their chest as you were standing face-to-face to talk. So this was recognising them, looking them up on database, and then putting their name on their chest so that you could say, hello, Bob, or hello, Fred. And we were all playing with it because it was a nerdy conference. But we're going to see more and more of that, and it will become in common use. The police are now trialling mounting that sort of camera in their cars so they can recognise a face as they drive down the street, look it up on their database, and see whether it's a person of interest. Facial recognition will be a standard thing that we use more and more.
Something else that we'll use more of is GPS in cars. As we heard at the start of the program, in Wollongong, the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority has been testing a new device called Intelligent Speed Adaptation Technology. It uses satellites to remind drivers what the speed limit is on a stretch of road. The RTA's Chief Technologist for Road Safety is John Wall.
Well, essentially, it looks very much like your satellite navigation system that you've got. So it's just a small mobile phone size device that's fixed to the vehicle. It has a display on it so people can look down and they can actually see the speed limit of the road at any time that they're driving on the network. If they can't see a sign, for example, they can look down on their device and the speed limit will be displayed. It only really starts to warn you if you start to go over the speed limit. But it will tell you when you change speed zones. And importantly, one of the features that we had built into this system was to make sure that it let people know when they were in the school zone as well.
School zone active.
It shows you the speed limit and beeps annoyingly when you exceed it. These devices can also slow the car down automatically. Others, guided by satellite, won't even let you drive faster than the speed limit. There's been a trial in Japan between a phone company and a car maker of a device that warns drivers if a pedestrian's about to jump out in front of them. Already fitted in some cars are devices that tell emergency services if the car's crashed. John Wall.
What we call e-call is an important function that GPS can play in saving lives, and we already see that here in Australia to a very limited amount. But over in the US, the OnStar project from General Motors is something that is doing that today, where if a vehicle is involved in a collision, it will automatically call police, medical and rescue services to let them know that there's been a crash, can even tell operators how many airbags have gone off in the vehicle and the likely severity of injuries of patients as well.
And the list of things you can do with satellites, especially GPS, goes on and on. Up in Queensland, the CSIRO is working on what's called a fenceless farm. Cattle are wired up with GPS receivers and batteries.
So this is a control collar with small speakers positioned just under the animal's ears on a sort of a halter. And then there's a collar that goes around the animal's neck, has some batteries and another box for electronics.
In Brisbane, CSIRO livestock scientist Greg Hurley-Bishop.
Initially, the animals get an audio cue, and then if they don't obey the audio cue, then they get a mild electric shock, and that is what turns them around from the virtual fence line.
You could be sitting at home with a computer and adjusting where the cattle are feeding. You could send them in a different direction. You could round them up.
I mean, I think those are all applications of this technology once we get it to the point where it can be on the animals for long enough. And certainly the interest is in exactly that, where you might be able to, over a period of a week or two, muster the animals using this technology. You can move them around to the areas where there's more pasture and you're not constrained by where your physical fences are.
And similar technology, minus the electric shock, is also being used with prisoners and people with dementia to keep an eye on them. Down the track, it could also be used for crowd control, and privacy's one of the big emerging issues with this technology. One of the reasons governments launched satellites in the first place was to keep an eye on their enemies. GPS and high-resolution cameras have taken that to a whole new level. For some reason, we don't seem to be as worried today about what's up there looking down as we were back in 1958 when Ray Anderson and the Home Folks penned this song.
Budniks and mudniks flying through the air. Budniks and mudniks flying everywhere. They're so ironic. Are they atomic? Those funny missiles have got me scared. The strangest looking objects I ever saw from space, with a dog inside that got to ride into the USA to see our hound dog or American groundhog. That Russian canine can't stand the pace. Sputniks and mudniks flying through the air. Sputniks and mudniks flying everywhere.
About a quarter of the almost 1,000 working satellites in space are still military satellites. Australia shares satellite secrets with the US through its joint tracking station at Pine Gap, near Alice Springs. The Australian Department of Defence also leases part of an Optus satellite, and it's planning to buy a satellite and build another. The last time we built our own satellite, military or otherwise, was in 2002, when FedSat, a small research satellite, was launched from Japan. It had a short life and is now a piece of space junk. FedSat was designed and tracked from this building at the University of South Australia on the outskirts of Adelaide. This is still a satellite ground station.
Have you got a few minutes?
Sure.
Here, the Institute for Telecommunications Research develops gadgets used to track satellites and download the data. Government departments and universities use satellites for research to monitor things such as land clearing and climate change, for predicting and fighting fires and floods, and for lots of other things. And that's why a satellite owned by the Australian government would be handy. The Institute's director is Dr. Alex Grant.
That's where you have the advantage of being able to task a satellite for a role that has a particular national priority and a particular interest to us here in Australia, and have access to that data. You know, we do use a lot of data sets from international satellites that we either pay for or are given access to. Now, you know, I don't think there's anyone saying that suddenly might be taken away from us. However, we're not holding up our end in terms of being an international citizen, of contributing to that whole space ecosystem.
Orbiting around the Earth are more than 2,000 satellites, dead and alive, as well as thousands of large pieces such as lenses, hatch covers, bolts, and tools that have escaped from shuttles and space stations. Space archaeologist Alice Gorman.
And there's also a wonderful story of a manhole cover that was part of a series of nuclear explosion experiments that is supposed to have attained sufficient velocity to get into orbit. And so many claim that is actually the first human thing that made it past Earth's gravity and into space. So as with a lot of space events, it can sometimes be difficult to say, well, this one was actually the first to do it, because there's a lot of national prestige tied up with this kind of thing. There can be quite a bit of debate and dispute about which country can claim primacy in any particular achievement.
The first man-made object into space may technically have been one of the Nazis' V2 rockets, developed at the end of the Second World War. Some of them reached an altitude of just over 100 kilometres before dropping to explode on London in 1944 and 1945. Most things launched into orbit eventually fall back to Earth, but many remain in orbit so high they'll never come down. And it's not just bits of metal and glass. Animals have been sent into orbit, and some might still be up there.
There are cats, dogs, mice, spiders, all kinds of things. The French launched a whole bunch of mice into space. One of them was called Hector. And generally they would try and bring them back, because that was an important part of the study. Like, how had they survived? What had happened to them while they'd been in space? My suspicion is most of them have probably re-entered, but that you never know this until you actually, you know, have a look at the data. Because if that were the case, this is a really valuable source of data. We could then, once we're in a position to recover or visit those spacecraft, analysing the impacts of organic material being exposed to the space environment for that length of time could be really, really valuable for working out what the long-term effects on living humans might be.
Alice Gorman. With all these things now in orbit, the risk of collisions is making space travel dangerous. Many of these objects are travelling at about 17,000 kilometres an hour, so you can imagine what happens when two objects travelling at that speed collide. Brett Biddington.
Spaces, particularly around the poles, becoming very cluttered. And indeed, there was a collision between an old Russian satellite and a working Iridium satellite. So it drove into the side of the other one.
There's enough junk up there now for the chances of collision to be so increased
and
that they'll
worse,
happen.
You see, what happens if you have a collision? Two bits of junk or two objects become many thousands because of the speed of the impact. So you make it worse and worse and worse. And one of the space shuttles was hit, one of the windows, by a fleck of paint, which was tracked back to a French satellite or launcher. The space shuttle windows are 2 inches thick, and this thing just penetrated and fractured the glass into about 4 or 5 layers.
Is this going to be a big issue?
It's a huge issue. And in fact, the Americans currently track about 25,000 pieces relevant to them. There are millions of pieces up there, including the tiny flecks and so on, and all can do damage, huge damage, just through straight impact.
To avoid this, satellites are now designed to propel themselves into what's called a graveyard orbit just before they die. There are also various plans to vaporise debris with lasers, and somehow gather it up and keep it away from working satellites. To give you an idea how cluttered it's getting, there's a link to a model of orbiting satellites and space junk on the Background Briefing website. One of the other potential perils for satellites and our economies as we come to rely more heavily on satellites is from solar storms. Once every 11 years or so, there's a flurry of sunspots, and these bursts of energy can disrupt electronics and the orbits of satellites. The next cycle of sunspot activity is due to start next year. But that's not slowing down the rush now to send more and more satellites into orbit. Increasingly, smaller companies are getting in on the act. Businessman John Douglas.
The satellites are getting smaller and smarter. We now talk about nanosatellites. You know, satellites used to be half a ton or a ton in remote sensing, and they used to cost a billion or two. Now we're talking about the little rabbit eye constellation of things, you know, not much bigger than a large fridge that might cost 20 or 30 million each. And now we're talking about nanosatellites that, you know, like you could hold in your hand with special sensors, and you chuck a cluster of these things up and they last for 3 years or 2 years, and by that time they're out of date anyway. So we should not be thinking about what was great in the past. We should be getting on the train. So if making nanosatellites for $50,000 a piece, but those nanosatellites in a constellation worth, say, $500,000, can produce data over a whole continent that's worth $100 million, I know which part of the business I want to be in.
The other big business opportunity looming for space may be tourism. British businessman Richard Branson 2 weeks ago sent his passenger spaceship on its maiden voyage. It was a test run and didn't get into space this time, but the idea is to send more than 300 paying passengers 100 kilometres above the Earth, perhaps later this year. And that will again change how we use and view space and how the future of technology and the planet unfolds. Brett Biddington.
You certainly do see the curve of the blue planet. You certainly see the atmosphere. You certainly get that sense of fragility that so many astronauts have talked about, that I think have given a group of people who have experienced this a sense of just how the whole world is actually one system. And if you do interfere with one part of it significantly, it is bound to have an effect somewhere else.
And that's one of the big reasons why we need to be up there looking back.
It's the perch. It's a great perch from which to see back onto the planet the bigger sort of trends and effects and impacts, particularly the human impact, of course, whether it's in cities, whether it's in pollution, the human impact is profound.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. The technical operator is Phil McKellar. And the executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. I'm Ian Townsend, and you're listening to ABC Radio National.